Okay, so last time we discussed Lorentz transformations, which are linear transformations mapping space-time onto itself. And the amazing discovery, initially due to Maxwell and then Lorentz and other people, was that Maxwell's equations are invariant under such transformations. And they became then the model for all future theories of physics. So when Einstein invented the Einstein equations in general relativity, his prime criterion was to respect this invariance, in fact, to generalize it. But they certainly respect the special relativistic invariance, which Lorentz introduced. And then when Dirac invented the Dirac equation, essentially, all he was doing was trying to make an equation which, a quantum mechanical equation, which respected Lorentz invariance, and that was the Dirac equation. And when Yang and Mills invented the non-abelian gauge theories, which were eventually became the theories of the weak and strong nuclear forces, they were even more so just copying Maxwell. Maxwell opened the door to 20th century physics. I'm going to just continue a little bit with reviewing what these transformations mean from different points of view. One of the greatest insights was to understand geometrically what the Lorentz transformation means. And last time I drew a little bit of a parallel with rotations, that we know the laws of classical mechanics are invariant under rotations. If we look at a two-dimensional rotation, what I do is start with some coordinate system x and y, and then a different coordinate system, oriented differently by some angle theta. And this is the relationship between the coordinates of any point, x and y, if I measure the coordinates of the same point in the x prime and y prime coordinates, this is the relationship. And of course, just like Lorentz transformations preserve lengths calculated using eta mu nu, the rotations preserve lengths calculated using the usual metric on Euclidean space, which is just delta ij. So in relativity, all we're doing is generalizing these to space-time. And so if I write this as a matrix, what I'm saying here is that xi is oij, x prime I oij xj. This matrix, in this case, is a 2x2 matrix, cos theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cos theta. It's an orthogonal matrix because I have Oij, Olm, delta Jm equals delta Il. So this is entirely analogous to the Lorentz transformation. And if I write that as a matrix equation, this is the statement that O transpose equals 1. Just think about how you, what you mean here. When you do matrix multiplication, you contract the neighboring indices, and I need to transpose this guy so that the neighboring indices are contracted in the matrix product. In the case of, let's do a 2D Lorentz boost. And so now we are instead mixing up CT x, and we're going to have some new axes for t prime and x prime. And it's interesting to see what those axes look like. So we know what the transformation is. I told you last time, the lambda matrix, if I just focus on the 2x2 part of it, the part involving t and x, then it's cosh theta minus sinh theta minus sinh theta cosh theta. And this obeys lambda times the matrix minus 1, 1. Lambda transpose equals minus 1, 1, which is the analog of that equation. And if I write down the coordinates, then I have CT prime is CT cosh theta. Remember, we had x prime equals lambda x. And so CT prime is CT cosh theta minus x sinh theta. And x prime is x cosh theta minus CT sinh theta. So in particular, you can ask, well, where is the t prime axis in the, you see the, when this rotation, I can ask, where is the y prime axis? And the y prime axis is, of course, where x prime is 0. And the x prime axis is where y prime is 0. So the t prime axis is where x prime is 0. So this tells us, so the t prime, ct prime axis is given by x equals tan theta ct. Okay, so that is something like this. And the x prime axis is given by t prime equals 0. And so obviously this is given by ct equals x, or let's write it the other. Why did I, I'm not sure why I wrote it that way. Let me write it as ct equals cot times x, and then this one is ct equals tan theta times x. So you see these two things are inverses. And so what it's telling you is that the new axes get squeezed. Okay, so there is this parameter, theta, looks a little bit like an angle, but it's not really an angle. And if theta equals 0, these two axes are on top of each other. But as theta increases up to infinity, the slope of these lines, so this slope is always greater than 1, and the slope becomes 1 in the limit as theta goes to infinity. This one is always less than 1 and becomes 1. So as you increase theta, these two lines converge on the 45-degree line. And so from this point of view, Lorentz transformations, as I said, are just maps from space-time to itself. And there are, if you like, two copies of space-time. The copy that the observer, let's call this guy O, who uses these coordinates, CT and X. And then there might be another observer, O prime. In particular, if somebody is traveling along this line, so they are moving in O coordinates at velocity v, because you see x is, so I can write this equation that, or I can write this equation, x equals c tan theta t. So this is the velocity of observer located at x prime equals 0 in the original coordinates. So you have this picture of two different observers who use different coordinates, the ones which are natural to them, t to describe the same events in space-time. And so I can make a grid of x and ct coordinates, and so every event in space-time is some point in that grid. Or I can make a grid in ct prime x prime coordinates where I just pick lines parallel to those axes, and that clearly covers space-time. And you can see it's absolutely impossible to run into any contradiction in this way. It's just mapping a space onto itself, one-to-one, so there's no danger of any inconsistency. But and so once you see this geometrical picture, you realize there can't really be any problem. Nevertheless, you will always find lots of papers about possible inconsistencies where people mess around with the algebra and make a mistake and then find some contradiction. But there really can't be any such contradiction. This picture of space-time and Lorentz transformations as transformations on space-time is due to Minkowski, and that's why this is called Minkowski space-time. So this geometrical picture of space-time. And just with everyone, as with everyone else I mentioned, it's really worth looking at Minkowski's paper on this. Minkowski was a mathematician, but his paper is really beautiful, and he explains all the phenomena of time dilation and Lorentz contraction and so on in a geometrical way using this picture. He also made an interesting observation. You see, just like we have this law that the distance squared is invariant under rotations, we similarly have that ct prime squared minus x prime squared equals ct squared minus x squared. And that's the notion of length in Minkowski space-time. Let's say, Pythagoras' rule in Minkowski space-time. And what Minkowski noticed is that if I, in fact, it's a little bit nicer to put the minus sign in front of the time, because there are more of these coordinates. And if I go in general to three dimensions, this equation is still true for Lorentz transformations. That's obvious, because the left-hand side is just x nu eta mu nu. And of course, we know this is basically lambda. Let's write it this way. And so, in fact, if I write it properly, it'll be x transpose lambda transpose eta lambda x, and this is eta. So this is equal to x nu, eta mu nu, in general, for Lorentz transformations. And so this is Pythagoras' rule in space-time. It's the invariant distance squared. And what Minkowski noticed is that if I set t equal to I tau, or ct, equal to I c tau, then Lorentz, then we get the usual Pythagoras rule. Okay, so this was actually, it's kind of a trivial observation that if you pretend time is imaginary, pure imaginary, the Lorentz transformations are simply rotations in this space. If you're going to do that, you notice that you better so you have, once you make the time imaginary, you better keep it imaginary. And the way you keep it imaginary is by putting eyes into the rotations. So sine of theta becomes I sinh theta. Cos theta, of course, becomes cosh theta, where theta, let's say phi, where theta is I phi. So you can think of Lorentz transformations as rotations in an angle which is imaginary. And then everything is consistent. In fact, this is an incredibly profound point of view, okay? Because when you come to do path integrals in quantum mechanics, I'm not sure you've done them already, but you will sometime this semester do path integrals. And you will discover that all the laws of physics can be written as some integral like that, where S is the action. And what is S? But S is an integral dt of some Lagrangian. And so if I make time imaginary, I can rewrite this as minus integral dtor times the Lagrangian over h bar. And in that case, quantum mechanics becomes thermodynamics, because this turns out to be nothing but the Boltzmann distribution, where the temperature is h bar. And so this trick of making time imaginary takes you from Euclidean space, which is maybe the simplest possible space with positive metric, delta ij, takes you from Euclidean space thermodynamics to special relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay? All using this I. Okay, it's a very clever trick. And in fact, this trick is used now. So in QCD, when people calculate the mass of the proton using lattice gauge theory, they use this trick. So this is still not fully understood, what the significance is. What is this thermodynamics going on in imaginary time? And quite how is it quantum mechanics? But it's certainly a very profound observation. Okay, so let's focus on some more elementary things. One thing we can see, as I mentioned, is that if I do this transformation, and I'm going to regard it as a transformation from one observer's coordinates to another, you can see there's a limit. As I take theta to infinity, right, the O prime observer cannot go faster relative to the O1 than the speed of light. Because as I take this limit, theta goes to infinity, this velocity of the O prime observer in the O coordinates goes to 1. And you can't get bigger than 1, okay? So the Lorentz group is a bounded group. It cannot take you from an observer going less than the speed of light to another one going faster than the speed of light. All you can do, the maximum speed which you can generate with a Lorentz transformation, is the speed of light. Now, in fact, what I've shown you, let's see if this will work. Sorry, I went went in exactly the wrong direction. Oh no. That's interesting. Maybe this is broken. That's very interesting. Okay, I think this is broken. I have to report that. I'll stick to manual. Okay, so in fact, we've shown note. So V is the relative. V equals C tanh theta is the relative velocity of O and O prime. So it's natural to express the Lorentz transformation, in terms of V. Where obviously V is less than C. And so notice that cosh theta is, of course, 1 over square root 1 minus tanh squared theta is 1 over root 1 minus V squared over C squared. And by definition, that's gamma in relativity. And then sinh theta is, of course, tanh theta times cosh theta. And so that is gamma V over C. And so the Lorentz transformations become, so LT, the Lorentz transformation is CT prime equals, I'm just going to write it in terms of T. In fact, T prime is gamma T minus Vx over C squared. X prime is gamma X minus Vt. And the inverse, so I can go back and forth between X and X prime. That's useful. The inverse is that T is equal to gamma T prime plus V over C squared X prime. So you just reverse the V to go to the inverse. X is gamma X prime plus V T prime. Okay, so I'll call this 1, 2, inverse 1, and inverse 2. So these are the equations which appear in all the classic papers on special relativity. Note that light rays x equals plus or minus ct are mapped to x prime equals plus or minus ct prime. Okay, so something moving at the speed of light is just mapped to the speed of light. And you can see that in the picture. If something's going up the 45 degree line in one coordinate system, and I rotate the two axes towards each other, it's still going up the 45 degrees line in the new coordinate system. So light is mapped to light. And the general result is the following, is that if I consider some light ray and just consider two points on the light ray, so let's take some small space-time vector, dx mu, along a light ray, then if, well, if it's a light ray, then eta mu nu dx mu dx nu equals 0. then it follows that because this is invariant, e to mu nu, dx prime nu equals 0. So Lorentz transformations map light rays to light rays. And in fact, you can reverse the argument. The argument, the most general transformations Yeah, in fact, I'm going to say something more about this later, so let me not say this now. Because there's actually a larger class of transformations that map null rays to null rays, which are the conformal transformations. Let's get more concrete and talk about clocks. So what is a clock in the space-time point of view? Well, a clock is something which ticks. And so a clock is sitting, let's say, at x equals 0. And it's moving up in time. And so a clock that, that ticks once every second will be 3 times 10 to the 8 meters up this axis. The ticks will be separated by 3 times 10 to the 8 meters up the CT axis. And if I have some, if this observer O prime is carrying a clock as well, well, their clock is going to tick along their time axis because they're located at x prime equals 0. So the coordinate grid for O prime is a set of lines like this. And so if some event occurs in the O prime, well, if some event occurs, then O prime will assign coordinates to it given by its the intersection of this horizontal line with the CT prime axis. That'll be the T prime coordinate. And the X prime coordinate will be the intersection of the line parallel to the CT prime axis. So we'd like to know what's the relationship between the ticks of the clock carried by O prime and the ticks of the clock carried by O. Now, the moving clock, and we're going to assume the clocks are identical. So the moving clock has x prime equals 0. And so it follows from I1. So I1 leads to t is gamma t prime. So it means that if the clocks are ticking at 1 second in the T prime, in the O prime coordinate system, then in the O coordinate system, they tick at gamma times 1 second. And gamma is a number which is bigger than one. And so this is called time dilation. And it means that somebody who's moving, their watch will appear to go slow. For us, okay. So if you want to stay young, keep moving. if you move around a lot, you will age much less than people who stay still. And this was the first indication of a similar effect in general relativity. Who among you have seen the film Interstellar? Did you like it? Yeah, it's pretty cool. So Interstellar, of course, the guy comes back and his daughter is about to die. because she's much older than he is. And so you get this effect first in special relativity, but then also in general relativity. And of course, you can see this is perfectly compatible with, x is the clock is moving with, I guess if we look at I2, you see x is gamma vt prime, which is vt. So the clock is moving with velocity v, but its time does not agree with the time as measured by the moving clock. And in fact, a classic example, one of the first experimental confirmations of this was muons coming through the Earth's atmosphere. Muons have a certain lifetime, a fraction of a second, and it's so small that unless there was time dilation, the muons would not reach the surface of the Earth. It's just too great a distance in the atmosphere. But because of time dilation, the muons are moving relativistically, and so it takes them much longer to decay relative to us than they would decay when they're at rest. And that boost in their lifetime allows them to reach us and be measured on the surface of the Earth. And there are many other examples. And the Large Hadron Collider, for example, verifies this equation to many, many decimal places. It's useful for relatives for explaining, most of us have a problem of explaining to our relatives why we do what we do. And it's always useful to have simple ways of explaining things. And one of the simplest ways of explaining this time dilation is the following, that you see, the basic idea in relativity is there's a special speed. Light is really special, and its speed is absolutely special. And if that's the case, then it makes sense to build your measuring devices out of light. Okay, so if you want to make a clock, the most fundamental clock you could make would be to have two mirrors and just to bounce light off the mirrors. And then this of course, if the distance between the mirrors is L, then you would define the time to be, the time is, of course, L over C. It's really 2L over C. I'll write it as 2L over C. So I can make if I have a ruler, of some length, I can make a clock by just bouncing light back and forth between the ends of the ruler, and then the ticks of the clock are separated by 2L over C. And now if I say that I'll take that clock and have it moving, so then my light ray would do this. And now it's obvious that the ticks of the clock take longer, right? So imagine I'm sitting on a train, and there's a mirror on the floor, and there's a mirror on the ceiling, and I bounce the light off between the floor and the ceiling. Well, obviously, the light's taking longer because there's further to travel. And so the ticks, as you see, I would say I'm sitting stationary with my light going up and down like this. Somebody else has the same clock but is sitting on a train. And if I'm asked, what's the time interval between the ticks of this guy's clock, I would have to say it's between this moment and that moment. Okay? And so if this train is moving with a velocity v, this distance is vt, this is L. And so you see that, and this distance from here to there is ct, because in a time interval t, according to the stationary observer, this light traveled at the speed of light. And so you definitely have that Vt squared plus L squared equals Ct squared. And so T squared equals L squared over C squared minus V squared. And so you get that T let me call it L over C. L over C is the once. Okay, you should multiply it by 2 in order to get both. And so this time is L over C root 1 minus V squared over C squared. So you get exactly the right answer. So that's the sort of physical picture for why you get time dilation. It's just because the light has further to travel. Now, slightly more subtle effect is with rulers and Lorentz contraction. So we measure distances with rulers. And let's now define what a ruler is. And so a ruler is, of course, an object with two ends. And according to O, a ruler would just be a sheet in space-time. The two ends follow world lines, and the rulers in between. And then according to O prime, the ruler would be something which, again, is a sheet, but the ends of the ruler follow, maybe let me just try to make that a little bit more. The ends of the ruler follow the fixed coordinate lines let's just draw it like this. Okay, so this is Ct prime, this is x prime, and then a ruler is something in the Ct prime system, is something which has length L prime when measured at Ct prime equals 0. In other words, along the x prime axis. Okay, so I want to know the relationship between this L prime, this measured length, and the length of the ruler in the O coordinate system. Now, the length of the ruler in the O coordinate system is just this distance. Okay? Because according to the observer O, the ruler is here. The ruler at t equals 0 is here. Whereas according to O prime, the ruler, you know, by length, I actually mean the length of the ruler when t prime equals 0. So you see that they're measuring different things, completely different things. And there's no reason for them to be the same. And we can work out the relationship very easily just from the algebra. You see, this space-time point is t equals 0. But it's also I've labeled it differently. Yeah, t equals 0, it's x prime equals L prime. Okay, I know those two things about the ruler. I know that in the prime coordinate system, its length is L prime, and x prime is this coordinate. And I know that so I know these two facts about the ruler. This tells me, using I1, that t prime is minus v L prime over c squared. Okay, so if we look at I1, I know that t is 0, so t prime is minus lv over c squared. And you can see that from the picture, that I've got to, this is the length at, this is t prime equals 0, and I've got to propagate it a little bit back from t prime equals 0 to get the appropriate t prime coordinate. And now I know both x prime and t prime, I can get x, and this is using I2. So x is gamma L minus L prime minus V squared over C squared L prime. And that's L prime over gamma. And of course, this is what I would call L. The length of the ruler in the O coordinate is just the coordinate of this point in the O coordinate system. So what you see is that the length that L is equal to L prime over gamma. That things look shorter in the rest system than they do in the moving system. So this is very convenient. If you have a classic example is if I have a garage, which is too short to fit my car into, there's an easy way to fit the car in was to drive very fast. Okay, because when you drive the car very fast, the length becomes short, and then it'll fit in the garage, no problem. Okay, now it sounds like a contradiction, because the car is too long to fit into the garage otherwise, and it's a very interesting problem to see how that all works. But it's certainly true that you can fit a large car into a small garage. So again, it's useful to have a sort of more naive and physical picture of why that works. And just as we use clocks to, just as we use light to make a clock, if we had some fixed length, we can use light to make a ruler to measure lengths once we have that clock. Okay, so I've got this clock, which is bouncing light vertically, perpendicular to the distance I'm traveling. And I can use that clock to measure distances by sending light off parallel to the direction of motion. Okay, so imagine I'm sitting on a train, and I want to measure the length of the carriage. So I send the light ray off, and when it comes back, I'll say the distance, it's the time it took to come back is a measure of the length of the carriage. So I send off this light ray at time zero. It's got to travel the length of the carriage, which I'll say is L. But now L is the length of the carriage according to O, the guy at rest. Okay, so let's imagine we're sitting at rest. The train is moving along with speed v. And so therefore, the light is going to hit the end of the carriage at a time. So the light is coming along here. The light hit the end at t1, which is L plus vt1 over c. Okay, because of course, the end of the carriage moved an additional distance, vt1, as this light was traveling along. Okay, so the end of the carriage is moving away, and this is the time I hit it. You see, it's an implicit equation for t1. And so T1 is equal to L over C times 1 minus V over C. Now, of course, then the light's got to come back. The light comes back, and it hits the starting point. Well, while the light is coming back, of course, this end is moving. So this end has moved, and the light hits the end. Light hits the end. After a time t2, where of course t2 times t2 is given by t2 is equal to L minus vt2 over, this is the time interval between emitting it at the far end and it being received at the near end. That's an implicit equation as well, and this time the length is a bit shorter because the end it's coming back to has moved forward. Okay, so this tells you that T2 is L over C 1 plus V over C. So you conclude that the total time is equal to L over C times 1 over 1 minus V over C plus 1 over 1 plus V over C. And this is just 2L over C times 1 over 1 minus V squared over C squared. Okay, so the motion of the carriage meant that this time was longer because the far end's moving away. This time was shorter because it was because the original end is moving forward. The net effect is to take longer. So in other words, this term wins over that term. They don't quite cancel. They cancel at order V over C, but they don't cancel at order V squared over C squared. So the net effect is longer. And so this time is, of course, T, the time in the O rest frame. But we already know that T is gamma T prime. Okay, and so this is equal to, so T is equal to, T is gamma T prime, and we know what T prime is. T prime is the time in the frame of the train, and T prime is just 2L prime over C. Because whatever the length of the train is in the T prime in the O prime frame, the light travel time is just 2L prime over C. And so if we use both of these equations, we see that L is L prime over gamma. Okay, because this factor here is gamma squared. And so the length in the stationary frame is the length in the moving frame divided by gamma. Okay, so probably you can't explain that to relatives, but it does give you a physical picture that of why you get Lorentz contraction. Okay, are there any questions? Everything clear? So let us take our little break. what would you like to discuss? Sure.
Why? I don't know very much about this, but we always think of light as having a constant speed, and it's just a propagator of a force. Do we assign some kind of similar thought to other forces?
Yes. So the basic intuition which led to this picture was actually Michael Faraday's. Okay, so Michael Faraday saw all these forces at a distance, and Newton believed there was force at a distance. You know, the object over here influences an object over here instantaneously in Newton's picture. I mean, when and Faraday thought long and deeply about this, and he said it's just ridiculous. Okay, how can it be that somebody moving an electric charge on the other side of the universe would cause a force where I am to change instantaneously? Doesn't make any sense. Okay, so Faraday tried to convince all his contemporaries that the only picture which made sense is that forces were mediated by something, that there really was a field, a gravitational field, that every point in space-time, there's something which tells the particle where to go. Electric fields, magnetic fields, you know, he did all these experiments and he began to believe they were real. If you throw iron filings down in a magnetic field, you know, you see them all respond to the field. So it's a totally intuitive picture, but he said space must be full of fields. And then secondly, he didn't believe anything could move instantaneously. So there must be some limit. And then, of course, Maxwell came along and showed, indeed, that's the case, electric and magnetic fields and disturbances in those fields move at the speed of light. So that means if I hold an electric charge and I shake it up and down, you won't detect anything of that until there's been time for the influence to reach you. As I said, that became a model for all of physics. So when you think of all the forces, gravitational general theory of relativity is built on special relativity. And so when we get gravitational waves, they only travel at the speed of light. Forces can only change at the speed of light. So if I'm sitting here going around the sun, and somebody moves the sun suddenly by a few meters, I would see absolutely no effect until there's been time for that change to propagate through space. Quantum chromodynamics, the nuclear force obeys the same principle, the weak force, the Dirac equation, everything respects this symmetry. And you see, so for example, when experimentally, a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago, people in Italy measured the speed of light for neutrinos. The speed of neutrinos, and found they were going faster than the speed of light. And so there was huge excitement. I mean, this happens from time to time in fundamental physics. There's some experiment which causes a dramatic burst of interest. But most of us felt, you know, this is just not possible. By now, we know too many things which are consistent with the idea of relativity, that if we discover one natural phenomenon that contradicts it, it makes us very dubious. Okay, that's not very healthy because, of course, you know, we should be open to new things, and nothing would be more interesting than to prove this wrong. But relativity has been an extremely profound guide. And it's more than just a speed. You see, there is the special speed, but that's a matter of dimensions. I mean, you can always choose units in which it's one. And as you see, it's not so much a speed, it's a symmetry. There's a symmetry. And so it turns out as soon as you break that symmetry, okay, so when we write down the laws of physics, the Dirac equation or electromagnetism, whatever, we're always careful to respect the symmetry. And it turns out if you break that symmetry by even a tiny amount, all kinds of disasters happen. Okay. One of the example sheets you'll do is, you know, you can go back and kill your grandparents. You run into logical contradictions. You run into instabilities. One example is that the photon travels at the speed of light, according to Maxwell's theory. But if you start introducing terms in the theory which don't respect relativity, not only does the photon no longer go at the speed of light, you discover there are other photons. You know, there are qualitative changes. It's not just the speed. It means, so there are fields called ghost fields which appear. And basically, the theory becomes very sick. These symmetries are essential to the consistency of the theory in a million different ways. And so the more you learn this year, you will realize how this Lorentz symmetry is protecting you against various disasters. So we've grown to believe it is fundamental. Lots of papers on violating Lorentz symmetry, breaking it in some way. Lots of papers suggesting that quantum gravity effects would create changes in special relativistic formulae and propagation speeds and so on. But those proposals are very slim. I mean, they don't really have solid theoretical machinery behind them. And so most people are quite skeptical. So it's not simply a matter of measuring a speed. It's if we did measure something to be going faster than light, or we measured some fundamental speed that was different than the speed of light, we would be in a severe logical contradiction, and the whole rules of physics would have to be changed. Maybe that'll happen, but so far the experience is that it hasn't. So yes, the speed of light is just built into everything. As soon as you say there's a symmetry, you can choose units in which it's one, and then all the laws of physics have to respect it. You run into inconsistencies if they don't. Okay, so that wasn't really a break. So I want to now discuss. I'm going to take a little break in a few minutes, give you a rest, because I'll tell you about some very exciting research in a moment. But I need to tell you a little bit more before I can tell you about that. Let's talk about the energy and momentum in an electromagnetic field. And so this is, again, another way in which Maxwell's theory led to special relativity. It guided Einstein, for example, to the equation E equals mc squared. And without electromagnetism, he would have never got there. Okay, so I'm going to explain exactly how he got there. The energy density in the electromagnetic field, rho em, is 1/2 epsilon naught e squared plus 1/2 b squared. So this was figured out in the 19th century. The momentum density that the electric and magnetic fields can exchange let's call it J momentum. It's not the electric charge current. It's the density of momentum. It's a vector. So if I integrate across space this quantity, I'll get the momentum being carried in the electromagnetic field. And this is 1 of mu naught C E cross B. So this was called a Poynting vector. And that quantity tells you how much momentum is being carried in the electromagnetic field. So this was sort of known before Lorentz, that you could emit energy into light and similarly momentum. But of course, when relativity came along, the question to ask is, how do these appear in a tensor equation? how do I combine these quantities into a tensor? And the answer is that they are combined into the energy momentum tensor. Okay, which for electromagnetism, T mu nu Em is equal to 1 over mu naught times F alpha mu F alpha nu minus 1/4 eta mu nu F alpha beta. Okay, so you can raise and lower indices, but be careful to keep them left and right of each other. So this is a left index, which has been lowered, so you have to make sure that they are ordered correctly. And so what you can show is that in the absence of charge or currents, i.e., if J mu equals zero, if the charge density is zero, then this stress energy tensor then is conserved. So Maxwell's equations imply d mu T mu nu Em equals zero. So that's the fundamental property of an energy momentum tensor. That's why we call it an energy momentum tensor, is because it obeys a conservation law like this. And of course, I can write this out in components. This tells me that d naught t naught naught plus di ti naught equals zero. And that tells me that if I integrate in some volume, t naught naught, and I take the time derivative of that integral, okay, this is equal to, by this equation, minus integral by this equation and the divergence theorem. This is equal to minus integral ds I T I naught. And so this quantity represents the flux of energy out of the region. And if I choose my surface so there is no flux on it, for example, if the surface is a long way away, then the energy would be conserved. Okay, so the fundamental property of energy is it's conserved. And when you have this kind of local conservation law, it gives you a conserved quantity. Now, as well as this, which is the zero component of the equation, we also have the three I components of the equation. And they read like this. And in an exactly similar way, we get integral d3x t naught I d by dt of this equals the surface term. And if there's no flux of momentum, this is conserved. And so we call this PI IC, where PI is the momentum. And I had to put the C in there because you notice T mu nu is a single object. It better have the same dimensions. All components have to have the same dimensions. And P times C has the same dimensions as energy. P is a mass times a velocity. So this would be a mass times a velocity squared. And kinetic energy has that dimension. So let's prove that statement, that d mu of t mu nu Em is zero if Maxwell's equations hold. So let's let's just prove that. So d mu t mu nu em is equal to 1 over mu naught. Now, I've got to differentiate these guys. I'm going to use Maxwell's equations, which are d alpha f alpha mu equals 0. That's one of them. And the other equation is this d alpha f beta gamma anti-symmetrized equals 0. Okay, those are the two Maxwell's equations. So when I take the d mu of t mu nu, first of all, it hits this f, but that one's obviously 0 because the mu is contracted with this mu. So I only get the next term, which is f alpha mu f d mu f nu alpha. Okay. And then I've got to differentiate the second term. The two factors are identical, so I get minus 1/2. And then I have eta, well, eta mu nu with d mu gives me a d nu. And then f alpha beta. And then I have, let's see, f alpha beta, and then an f alpha beta. Okay. Now, you notice something about this term, which is that this f is antisymmetric on these two indices. Okay. So I can rewrite this one as 1/2 d mu f alpha nu minus d alpha f mu nu. And this equals the original expression just because the f is antisymmetric. So you see basically what I have is f multiplied by first derivatives of f, and I have three terms. Okay? Now, 1, 2, 3. And it's not much of a stretch to believe it's exactly this equation. Okay? So I'll leave that to you to check that this is 0 because d alpha f mu nu plus d nu f alpha mu plus d mu f nu alpha equals 0. Yes. Oh, that one can't be erased. sorry about that. The only thing I can do is move this. Where are you? Is that better? Slightly. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so those are the energy and momentum in the electromagnetic field, and all we've shown is that they are conserved as long as the current-free Maxwell equations are satisfied. Notice from these equations that you see, Ti naught is the flux of energy, right? From this equation. Ti naught measures the flux of energy. The momentum, but it's the same thing as the momentum density. So the momentum density is the same thing as the flux of energy, in fact, up to a factor of C. So because the units have to agree. So note the momentum density equals the energy flux over C. So what is energy flux? It's the rate of passage of energy per unit area per unit time. Okay, and the momentum density is the the density of momentum per unit volume. So those two things agree. You see the C converts the per area into per volume, and then the T, C is the length over time, the T converts the rate into something, or eliminates the dimensions corresponding to the rate. So let's take as an example, e.g., a pulse of light. And we already studied this, that the electric field in a pulse of light is 0, 0, some function of x minus ct, an arbitrary function of x minus ct. The magnetic field in this case is just 0 minus the same function of x minus ct over c to get the dimensions right. And zero. So here's our linearly polarized electric and magnetic field. The electric field's in the z direction, the magnetic field's in the y direction. And so now we can calculate the energy in that pulse. The energy, obviously, this function is independent of y and z. Y and z are the two transverse directions. So integrating over y and z, I just get the area. This is integral dy dz. The energy in the pulse is just that integral, just that area times the integral dx of epsilon naught, half epsilon naught e squared. I just take this formula, 1 half epsilon naught e squared plus a half b squared. The two terms are equal. And you end up getting epsilon naught f squared x minus ct. Okay, so that's the total energy carried by the pulse. And it depends on, you know, the transverse area. But if the pulse is just some form like this, then the integral is just some number. Now, the momentum pz times c. So you see from the formula over there that pc is the integral d3x of t0i. t0i is this e cross b term. And so this turns out to be a times integral dx times f squared x minus ct over mu naught c squared. Okay, where did all that come from? Notice that j has a 1 over mu naught. It's the same 1 over mu naught that is in here. There's a 1 over c because e over c is what appears in the t mu nu. And so now it's clear using the speed of light, c squared is 1 over epsilon mu naught. You see these two expressions are identical. So what we infer is that for a pulse of light, the momentum times c is equal to the energy. And in fact, it's plausible. I haven't shown it. But it's plausible that the magnitude of the momentum, the energy is a positive quantity, after all. The general result is that the energy is just the magnitude of the momentum times c. So this was a very important result, which is known from the 19th century, that if you send a pulse of light, its energy and its momentum are related in this way, by the speed of light. And roughly speaking, you can think of light as a particle. So this is sort of analogous to the formula in Newtonian physics, where the kinetic energy would be half mv squared. Okay, but here, mv is the momentum, and c is the speed. And there's no half. So all that was known. But it took Einstein to work out the consequence. And the consequence changed the world, as you know. I won't use this one again. Let me try to just use ones I can raise and lower.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Why is there a B squared?
Sorry?
Oh, PZ.
PZ. I can call it P. Yeah, PZ. That's a Z. Okay. Or P3. Actually, sorry, no, it's not P3. It's PX, in fact. Sorry. It's the momentum in the X direction. Sorry about that. Because E is in the Z direction, B is in the Y direction, and E cross B is in the X direction. Of course, the momentum of the photon is in the X direction. So this led Einstein straight to his equation, E equals mc squared. And I'm going to derive this formula three different ways. Okay, it's the most iconic formula in physics. It's the one formula the public know. And very good reasons for that. As I say, it changed everything when people realized that mass has some intrinsic energy. That was the foundation of the nuclear bomb, and then nuclear energy, and many other consequences. So Einstein's argument was the following. Again, well worth looking at his paper. It's only 4 pages long, has no references at all. Okay. Because these formulae from electromagnetism were just widely known. And so it's an almost trivial argument. But Einstein didn't realize the consequence, didn't realize that this meant you could get energy out of atomic nuclei by fusing them into larger nuclei. So the first argument was as follows. Imagine I've got some heavy object, M, and imagine this object is able to change into a smaller object with some mass less than M, less than capital M, with the emission of 2 photons. Okay, so I'm afraid there's a bit of ambiguity because we call photons gamma particles, and it's not the gamma in the Lorentz transformation. It's just the name of the particle. It has some energy. So imagine that this big object decays by emitting 2 photons in opposite directions, leaving behind a little mass m. So the question is, how does M change?
The mass change?
Okay, in other words, can we predict this little mass if we know that the object emitted 2 photons, each of energy E gamma? It's obvious from this formula that energy conservation would imply that the energy associated with mass big M is equal to the energy associated with mass little m plus 2 E gamma. Okay, so if we believe in energy conservation, we have to have that formula valid. Let's call that A. And now comes the clever part of the argument. See, Einstein had just worked out special relativity. And so what he knew is that if some physical process happens, you should be able to describe it in any moving frame. So he said, well, let's look at this process from the point of view of somebody who's moving with velocity v. Okay, so in particular, this thing is going on, but imagine I'm moving with velocity v in the negative direction. So according to someone who's moving, moving with velocity v in the negative x direction, according to them, the picture would be as follows, that this object here, m, would be moving, would be initially moving with some velocity v. It's clear in this picture that little m, after the event, is not moving anywhere. Okay, just emitted two back-to-back photons, and it's stationary. So therefore, in this picture, it must also be moving with velocity v. Okay, because they were both static in the original coordinate system, they must be moving with the same velocity in the new coordinate system. But in this coordinate system, of course, these photons would be coming out at an angle. And some angle theta, and the photons are coming out with some angle. Now, this is where a very clever part of the argument came in. Einstein knew that he knew that from Maxwell's theory how the photon energy transforms. Okay, so it's clear if I take a photon and I move, let's say the photon's coming at me, and I move towards the photon source. Obviously, the frequency is going to go up, and I get the Doppler shift. And so they knew all that formulae. But he knew that when I did this boost to go into the moving frame, the energy of the photon, let's call it prime. Yeah, let's call it prime. The energy of the photon, E gamma prime, is very nearly E gamma. It's E gamma plus order V squared over C squared, where V is the boost. And the reason for that is that it's perpendicular to the direction. So you can just take the momentum of the photon. See, the momentum of the photon is E, the four momentum. We'll come to the four momentum because we'll do it in a moment. But he knew that in this moving frame, the energy of the photon is the same as the energy it was in the original frame, up to some corrections of order V over C. For the argument, even if it was V over C, actually his argument is still valid. In fact, it's V over C squared. Now he's going to make an argument which is actually independent of the magnitude of V. You can take this velocity of the moving frame to be arbitrarily small, and Einstein's argument is still correct. And therefore, this correction can be made arbitrarily small. Okay. So now all he does is he applies momentum conservation in the moving frame, assuming V is much less than C. And so this, I'm just trying to move that up a bit. So that momentum conservation reads MV equals little mv. And then what's the momentum of the photon? Well, there are two photons, so it's 2 E gamma over C. We had this formula that the momentum is E over C. So it's 2 E gamma over C, but of course I'm not, the momentum in the x direction is just the x component of the momentum. So this is cos theta. Okay, but what's cos theta? Cos theta is v over c, because the velocity is v in this direction, the velocity in this direction is c, and so the component of so the angle between between the photon and the particle, cos theta is just v over c. And so now you see, so let's call that equation B. And so equation B implies, so now you notice, you see cos theta is v over c. I can just cancel all the v's. So I get an equation which is independent of the magnitude of v. That's the clever part of the argument. And what it tells me is that 2e gamma over c squared is capital M minus little m. So now he's related the energy of the photon in this primed coordinate system to the difference in the masses. And then according to equation A, I can also express the energy in terms of the energy difference. So this is energy m minus capital M minus energy little m over c squared using A. Okay, and so what he's shown is that the change in energy is related to the change in mass by dE is dm c squared. Okay, so now it becomes very plausible that if something has a mass m and it loses some mass, we know how much energy it's lost. So if it's lost all of its mass, presumably it has no energy. So if we just integrate this equation, we infer that E equals mc squared. If the particle had no mass, zero mass, presumably it has no energy. And so then you're left with this formula. So I think you'll agree that's an amazing argument. And as I said, it took people several decades to realize that this implied you could get energy out of nuclear, atomic nuclei. And when they realized that, then the nuclear bomb became possible. Okay, so now I'm going to give, I think I've run out of time. So tomorrow I'll give a second argument using four momentum. And then I'll also give a third argument. So tomorrow we're going to do Noether's theorem, which is the deepest point of view, because you can always ask yourself, what is energy anyway? I mean, you can find some tensor which is conserved, and you can do all the manipulations with things which you can show to be constant, but what really do they mean? And so the answer to what energy and momentum actually mean is Noether's theorem, and that tells you that they are a consequence of symmetry, that whenever you have symmetries, you have conserved quantities, and that's how they're defined. And the beauty of that is that independent of the details of the physics, of the interactions between particles, or whatever your laws are, if you have the symmetry, you have to have something called an energy, and when you work out the energy, you'll find E equals mc squared. Okay, it just follows very, very cleanly and beautifully from Noether's theorem. And as you probably know, Noether is a kind of local hero at Perimeter. She was one of the most brilliant mathematicians of the early 20th century. Einstein and Hilbert had discovered general relativity, but it was awfully confusing. And they got most things wrong. Einstein got his equations wrong first time around. They couldn't figure out, one of the most profound issues was how does energy fit in with general relativity, because energy is not obviously conserved in general relativity. And the person who came along and sorted it all out was Emmy Noether, who for her pains, you know, at that time women were not thought of as potential physicists. And so she was allowed to teach, but for no salary. And she had a very, very tough time. But nevertheless, her paper, which I'll describe next time, laid the foundation for all of 20th century physics. So Noether's theorem not only explains what energy is, what momentum is, it explains why electric charge is conserved, it explains why symmetries lead to conservation laws in particle physics. The whole of 20th century particle physics was based on her discovery. Of course, after she'd made the discovery, she went on to other things, and she thought it was all rather trivial. And she went and invented the foundations of algebra, 20th century algebra, so that most of her contributions are actually in pure mathematics. But for physicists, Noether's theorem is the deepest way of understanding all of this. Okay, any questions? No? You're awfully quiet. Okay. All right, well, I'll see you tomorrow. There's a class this afternoon?
Yes.
Okay, great.